In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I talk about how to determine pricing for a brand new SaaS app, small business banking, and selling to companies outside the US, as well as answer more listener questions. And I also ask Mike what his favorite food is without having given him any advance notice. Hey, Mike, what's your favorite food?
I don't know. I like sushi a lot.
All right.
That's I guess that's my answer.
I thought you were going to say whiskey.
Yes. Well, you know, you said food. I think if you said, we'll change that to grain.
This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 356. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we made. Aside from eating sushi this week, what's going on, sir?
Well, I'm looking to push a pretty major update to Bluetick that unfortunately breaks like all of the existing routing for the entire app. So I've been kind of watching to see like who is logged in and when they're logged in and what they're doing. And pretty much at all hours of the day right now, somebody is doing something. So it's kind of problematic to do to just kind of push out a major update like that. So I kind of have to wait till the weekend.
Yeah. It's a good problem to have, Mike, that you have so many people in your app that it's hard to push updates.
I know. It's funny. I was complaining to my wife. I was like, oh, this is totally a first world problem, but like, I can't push an update because people are using it.
Yeah. That's interesting. So with Rails, it like does shadow updates where it like waits for a particular server to not have anybody else. And we have like load balancers and a bunch of web servers, but I don't know. We have a process where like, no, there won't be downtime, right? Or it won't like lose your session when it updates. Is .NET still the old paradigm of if you load it and someone's in their session, they're going to lose stuff?
I think typically yes, but because of the way I have things set up, like I'm using an Angular app, so it's just like I have this session information. It's a token that gets passed back and forth with every request. So that's not really the issue. The issue is that the URLs that are being used inside the app, they're changing. So the next time they go to make a request, because they have all the JavaScript loaded on their client, the next time they go to make a request, it's going to fail. So even though their token information will be the same, it'll still authenticate. It's just there's nothing to authenticate to because it's not there anymore. That's really the problem. I really have to figure out a way to kind of force the client to say, hey, there's a new version of this. You really should like either click here or just automatically refresh the entire browser and be done with it. Yeah, that's really more the issue than anything else.
Got it.
And I've also got a bunch of trials that are set to convert into paid in the next week or two. I kind of made the next step to transition from a 30-day trial to a 14-day trial. So I'm going to see how that goes as well.
That's a good move. Shorten that trial. Get to 7. No, the shorter you make it, man, the faster you can test. This is my soapbox since day one of this podcast. Shorter trials are better. No trials, the best, because it's so easy to split test. But, you know, you want someone to get value. So it's like 14 to 7. You can split test faster. You get your money faster. It encourages people to get onboarded faster. But obviously, the shorter you go at a certain point, you give them so little time to get set up that you're going to have less returns, right? You're going to have fewer people making it to paid. So you got to find that balance. I'm hoping 14 works for you.
Yeah, and that's why I went to 14 instead of like 7, because I think that I think it's a good balance between giving somebody enough time and giving me enough time to reach out to them and to make sure that they get through all of the onboarding steps. Because if they don't, then clearly like they're not going to get any value out of the app, but I want them to get value before the end of the trial. So if they're not doing things in the app and they're not, you know, responding to emails or, you know, any of my onboarding stuff, then doing 30 days is not going to make any difference over 14.
Right. No, I agree. I have tweaked with trial lengths with pretty much every app that I've ever run. And I have found that you can just ratchet it down. And then when you go too far, it becomes kind of obvious. If you have any type of volume going through it and you know your numbers, you know the typical trial to paid, you'll either start getting complaints that the trial's not long enough, or you'll just notice people are not getting the stuff done on time. So I think this is a really good experiment. And if you get it down and stabilized at 14, I would totally look at like a 10-day next, you know, maybe in a couple months as you have time. And as your onboarding gets better, you can do that, right? Because it gets people through that part of the funnel quicker.
Yeah, 10 days might be interesting. The only, I think, issue there would be just that it's part of a week. Although I guess maybe it's not a big deal. I don't know. I'll probably test it at some point, I'm sure.
Cool. So we have a ton of new iTunes reviews, and iTunes reviews are so helpful to this podcast. They give us motivation to keep going. B, they help us rank higher, get more listeners. And right now we have 531 reviews worldwide in iTunes. One from Bob Moff recently said, "Filled with so much great content, you will explode." Kind of like that one. One from Rear Cog. He says, "The best. This podcast is amazing. I have a small app business and the advice they give is super helpful in my business. I listen to a number of podcasts for small business and passive income, and this podcast is the most beneficial to me." And then another one from Bree GF that says, "Thanks for an awesome show for startups. Thanks for providing a great show for us." So if you haven't ever left us an iTunes review, you don't even need to go in and write anything like these kind folks did. You can just deal with the clunky iTunes interface or Stitcher or Downcast. Click 5 stars. It takes 2 seconds. We'd really appreciate it. Today, we're answering listener questions. And if you haven't ever sent in a question, you can call our voicemail number, which is super cool because then we get to hear your voice. And that's 888-801-9690. And you can always email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. And we have 5 or 6 people today who did one of those things. So let's dive into our first one.
Hey, Rob and Mike, I just want to say, first off, I love the podcast. You are by far the most actionable podcast that I listen to in the small business world. My question today is about pricing. So I have a SaaS company starting up, and I know you've touched on pricing before in the past briefly, but I'd really love to hear you go more in depth on how you would figure out pricing for a new SaaS just getting off the ground. Thanks so much. I look forward to hearing from you.
So I think this is kind of a very general topic, but what I did for Bluetick for this specifically to try and find out what people were willing to pay for it was I asked them. So when I put people through the initial validation process and I started taking pre-orders for Bluetick, I asked them, how much value do you think that this provides to your business? And I gave them a text field and said, you tell me how much it is that you're willing to prepay for, and then we'll multiply by however for many months. And I got ranges anywhere from about, I think the lowest was, I got one $29. The other ones, most of them were between $47 and $50. And then I had one that came in at $100. So it gave me a good idea that the $50 price point was probably not out of range for most people. And that's what people thought it was worth. I think that there's other ways that you can do that as well. One of them is to anchor the pricing to something. So you can either anchor the pricing to the value that you provide. And in your copy and the things that you talk to people about, you say, look, this is what it's going to save you, or this is going to what it's going to help you avoid. And you can use that to figure out what the pricing should be, and you can use that copy to help you justify it to the customer. Another thing you can do is look at what competitors are out there and what their pricing looks like in comparison to what it is that you want to do. And then you can either go higher if you want to offer more of a premium offering, or you can go lower if you want to be more of a commodity choice or a lower end option for those people. But I'd say those are the probably things that I would look at. Rob, I'm sure you've got a ton of things to say about this. What do you think?
That's actually pretty good summary. A, ask, because you should be or are going to be doing customer development anyway. So you should ask early and then start, as you're doing customer development, start pitching at different prices to hear how people react. I think that's a great idea. Competitor pricing is always, it's always important, because people, if you say you have no competitors, you're probably fooling yourself, because even apps that don't have direct competition have some other form of competition. Even if it's an Excel spreadsheet and 3 hours a week of someone's time, that can be a competitor to you. So you can start just doing even loose math about what is 3 hours of someone's time worth in the role that they do this, and multiply that times 4.33, and that's 1 month. And now, all right, I'm going to charge a fifth of that, or a tenth of that, or, you know, something. Another way, you know, something that I did early with Drip was I kept asking myself, how can I build an app where the lowest price point was $99 a month? That was the initial kind of one of the brainstorms or one of the thought experiments I did. Now, by the time we launched, Drip was only at $49 a month, you know, but our average revenue per user is much higher than that because it scales up with subscriber count. But that's another way you can think about it, is to try to dig yourself out of this, you know, I'm going to be a $10 a month SaaS app or a $20 a month SaaS app to start. Those apps are going to be great little lifestyle businesses, but they are going to tend to have high churn, and it's really really, really hard to grow them past, depending on churn, let's say 20, 30, 40K MRR. It's just at that low price point, you have to find so many customers. And so I think it's an interesting angle to come at it from that other direction of, all right, I have expert, you know, I'm a developer and I know I'm building an app for X and I know it's like accounting for lumberjacks. And how can I make that worth $49 or $99 a month? Does it have to then, in order to provide that much value, go out and scrape people's bank accounts? Does it have to do 10 times what QuickBooks can do? You know, what does it have to do? So I think it's kind of a third angle to think about as you're doing this. And I think the last thing I'll say is with competitor pricing, I think competitors give you a really nice kind of a level set or, you know, comparable pricing of what someone might be paying. That doesn't mean you have to be the least expensive, right? That's the thing. I would tend to argue you probably want to be more expensive than most of the other ones. Now, maybe in the very, very early days, you can't be. But as soon as you start getting some traction and you're moving fast and shipping fast, people, depending on the industry, often want to use the new cool thing. You're going to probably have a better UI, better user experience. You're going to be more responsive because you're such a smaller company. And so when we priced against, you know, the MailChimp, Aweber's, Constant Contact, we are more expensive than all of those apps. And some people would say, well, I would just stick with MailChimp because I can save, you know, my 10, 20, 30% a month. And, you know, our answer was, well, we're more powerful, we're more responsive, our support's better and all that stuff. And even over time, you know, as we talked about a couple episodes ago, like our pricing is now even a little higher than just, you know, 20 or 30% over a MailChimp or Constant Contact. But we've earned that, right? And the kind of higher, you know, that price premium is a bit of positioning and positions us as much more of a premium offering in the space. So I hope that helps. Thanks for the question. Our next question is about creating a new product category.
Hey, what's up, Rob and Mike? This is Chris Badgett from Luther LMS, which is a WordPress learning management system solution for creating and selling courses and membership sites. I love your guys' podcast. My question for you, it's about introducing a new category. So we're growing really quickly, kind of disrupted the market a little bit with a free front-end product and an add-on model with premium pricing, and things are going really well, but we're about to pour gasoline on the fire and really kind of introduce a new category. And what I mean by that is something like similar to how Infusionsoft introduced the marketing automation category, and that was really big, but we see an opportunity in the learning space and how we can move into kind of a new category outside of just learning and courses and membership sites. I'm actually having a hard time naming it. I know what it's going to be and how it's going to work, but I want to pick that name, kind of like marketing automation or sales automation or those big category names, and make it simple and rememberable and not too techy and not using, you know, insider lingo and techno babble. So any advice on naming a category, a new category, which is going to involve some education and teaching people about that new category, is really appreciate that. But anyways, keep up the great work, guys, and thanks so much. I appreciate it.
So thanks for the question. This is a big one and an interesting one most people will not face in their lifetime. I think to start with, one thing, you know, you mentioned Infusionsoft introduced marketing automation. They, as far as I know, they did not. They just brought it down from the enterprise. So Marketo, Pardot, HubSpot, Eloqua, those guys were around at the time, or they were at least, they were kind of around, some of them. And Infusionsoft was around before that, but it was more like back office for lawyers and brick and mortar. And by the time they became marketing automation, there were other players. So I don't know that that's critically important, but it is, you know, a kind of clarification I want to make up front. So inventing a new product category is very, very hard and very expensive. And since you already have a business and you already have customers, you may be able to kind of guerrilla market this to them and have it spread. But I've been involved either peripherally or directly in this type of exercise before. And so, you know, one thing back in the day is I was looking for a different term for an entrepreneur who wanted to stay solo and you know, start small software companies. And so micropreneur is this term that I came up with, and got micropreneur.com, and we launched the academy, and, you know, all this stuff happened. And it was years and years and years of saying the same thing and talking about it and speaking about it and writing about it. And still the adoption of that term, there are some people who use that term, but really, even with the kind of reach into this space of those people, it still doesn't resonate with people, with a lot of folks. They don't call themselves micropreneurs. And, you know, there's a bunch of reasons why that might be the case. Number one, because it's just really fucking hard to come up with a new term that resonates with people and to define it and to have people get behind it. And another reason could be that perhaps the name itself, I didn't choose it very well. So meaning that maybe it's hard to say, hard to spell. It just maybe doesn't resonate with certain people. And so I think that's kind of the first takeaway is, A, are you sure you want to do this? It's going to be really, really hard. It's going to be a ton of money. When I think about like another one that I had a specific conversation with Dharmesh Shah from HubSpot. He and I've known each other for years, blogged, guest posted. We speak at conferences and we talk. And we talked about HubSpot, you know, inventing the term or getting behind the term inbound marketing. And they wrote a book and they pumped money and money and money into it. And it was a casual-ish conversation, but he was saying, it may have even been on Twitter actually, and he was saying it was $5 million or $7 million in years for them to get traction with that term to where people associated it with their company. And so it's just one, you know, it's a couple data points, but I will say that this is a lot harder than you think. So go in with that in mind. If you still want to do it, go in with that in mind. It's still definitely doable. And I think that nailing the name and nailing that concept of it is, you know, like inbound marketing, certainly those words existed in the English language before, but they brought it together and then they gave it this tight definition and then they just kept saying that definition over and over in different ways. And so that would be my advice with doing it is if you don't, I mean, honestly, I would consider if you're really going to do this, like hiring a design firm or a branding agency or somebody to help you with that name. Because if you know what it is, but it sounds like you don't have the name yet, the name may be 80% of the battle. And if you get that wrong, no matter what else you do, you're going to be hosed because that it just has to resonate with people. And it has to have a deeper meaning and conjure up a meaning in people's mind. And that's hard to do. You know, it's hard to come up with that on your own.
Yeah, it sounds to me like this is just one of those classic branding exercises. And I mean, when you're trying to come up with a brand, I don't view it as too much dissimilar from coming up with like a name for your product or your company. And I mean, you really need, it needs to fulfill a couple of different requirements. It needs to be easy to say, it needs to be easy to pronounce, easy to spell. You don't want people to misspell it or get it slightly incorrect and end up in the wrong places on the internet. But I think the fundamental thing that is the most important to that is it must resonate with people and accurately describe what it is that they do or, you know, what the product category is in a way that makes them affiliate themselves with whatever that term is. Kind of back to what Rob was saying before about like micropreneur and why that hasn't really caught on. It's like, I think people feel like, oh, I'm an entrepreneur. Like micropreneur sounds a little bit, I don't know, it's like you're couching how well you're doing at certain things and people want to be viewed as successful. So if you say micropreneur, oh, I'm a small entrepreneur. It's like, well, no, that's not really the whole point of it. So I feel like there's certain connotations along with that that probably turn some people off. So you need to make sure that you're cognizant of what those types of things are with whatever the term that you come up with is. And something else I'd think about is like, is there any real value in being known as the company that established this name or created the name? Like, is there something else that you could latch onto that isn't necessarily yours or wasn't created by you, but you could then build enough stuff around it? Because like Rob said, I mean, HubSpot spent, you know, millions and millions of dollars and tons of repetition saying the same things over and over to their customers and everyone else's customers that inbound marketing. And that's how they ended up making that into a term that people affiliate with HubSpot. You can do the same thing, even if you don't necessarily come up with a term. I'm hesitant to say that there's value in being known as the company that came up with a specific term. Like you said, marketing automation, and kind of as Rob pointed out, like Infusionsoft is not the company that came up with that. It was someone else. So it'd be very easy for people to misattribute it anyway.
Yeah. And last thing I would think I want to throw in is, given the importance of this, you know, there are people out there who come up with names. Now they're like naming experts and a lot of them do it for companies, but if you have the resources, since you already have a company that sounds like is profitable, the name is a critical piece of it. And someone who I heard recently on the Tropical MBA podcast, it was episode 401, What's in a Name? Listen to that episode and figure out if she might be a fit for you. I forget the name of the company, but it was a fascinating exercise because the Dan and Ian from Tropical MBA are wanting to rename their brand, their podcast. They want to get rid of the tropical part. They've now renamed twice. They were called the Lifestyle Business Podcast, and then they renamed to the Tropical MBA, and then they're, you know, renaming something else. And you can see how hard this is, because for them, the podcast is a bit of, it's part a movement, right? It's part of a new term that they're coming up with. And as their careers have shifted and their kind of businesses have shifted, you can imagine that it's difficult to pick something that's going to hang around forever. The cool part is that question and the thought about, you know, choosing a niche and a name is actually our next listener question. And it's from Ovi at socialbee.io. And he says, I have a question that applies mostly to Rob, but I'd like to hear both of your takes on this. Your podcast is geared towards solo founders and or bootstrapped entrepreneurs, quote, the rest of us. But as Rob is now part of a larger organization, he's switched boats a bit. So would you still name the podcast the way you did if you would have to pick a new name and a new niche now? Or to broaden the question, how do you pick your niche and even your name so you're sure you don't outgrow it yourself, or that if your preferences change, you're not stuck with your initial niche? Thanks. I'm a big fan and I appreciate your open discussions. Thanks for the great show. So I'll insert a little bit here, Mike, just because he asked that part about me, and then you can come in with your thoughts. What's interesting is I do work for a larger organization, but I actually don't feel like I've switched boats. Like, I'm still a bootstrap founder at heart. Even, you know, this is the thing, is you get into this mindset of like, if someone has raised any type of funding, are they still a bootstrap founder? You know, you look at Jordan Gall with Carthook, you look at Justin McGill with LeadFuse, you look at Churnbuster. Yes, they each raise small rounds, a few hundred thousand dollars. So are they still bootstrap founders? I mean, I guess by a technical definition, they bootstrapped to a certain point because they all had revenue and then they raised a small round. So maybe technically they're no longer bootstrap, but at heart, like, they're still super scrappy, super cash efficient, and they're not doing the, like, you know, $100 million company or bust. They're building real businesses. And that's the bigger difference I see, is it's like partly a mindset thing and it's partly how you approach problems. Jason Cohen, who is running WP Engine, which is, for what all of us know, I am an angel investor, but I have no inside information. I mean, they're either going to get acquired by a massive company or they're going to go, you know, have an IPO here. So big time stuff. But he still talks about bootstrapping in a way that at a higher level than most of us can. Still has given the best talk I've ever seen on bootstrapping. He bootstrapped WP Engine to a lot in revenue before he brought on any outside funding. So I guess I would probably push back on that a bit to say that since I am working inside a company of 150 people or whatever, that I am no longer like a bootstrap founder, because every problem I approach, I still approach it that way. And I guess all that to say is I still love the name Starters for the Rest of Us. I feel personally, and not just because I'm attached to it, but like, it embodies a different way of thinking about startups. And everywhere you look, you know, even as much as I love the Gimlet Media show Startup, it's just the same stuff. It's all about the Y Combinators and about these big companies and raising funding. And I mean, it's really well told and I enjoy the story, but it gets old. And I feel like on this show, the For the Rest of Us part is really saying, this is for people who want to build a real business instead of building slide decks. So anyways, I think that's my initial thoughts. What are you thinking, Mike?
Yeah, I think I agree with you, and probably for very similar reasons. And I think that I would stick with the name Startups for the Rest of Us. I still really like the name. The downside of it is, of course, that it's really long. So, you know, if you have to spell it out or kind of come up with an acronym, it doesn't suit it very well. But I think that the name itself, it resonates really, really well with most people. And here's why. I don't think that we really considered this back when we named the podcast this, but I had picked up startupsfortherestofus.com back when I read a Paul Graham article about them with Y Combinator and really targeting people who were fresh out of college and didn't have any expenses, and they could send $6,000 to them and basically invest in somebody's startup. And the expectation was, oh, you'll come and move to this location for 3 months, and that $6,000 per person is going to get you through. And I read it and I was like, well, what about me? What about the rest of us who can't do that because we've got a car and a mortgage and family, and we can't just up and leave for 3 months? So honestly, like, it really irked me at the time. But I look back at that and I realize that the gorilla in the startup space is really the funded startups. They're the ones you hear about all the time. They're the ones that get all the media attention and love. And they're the ones that get the massive news articles. calls and press coverage that we would like to have, but we just don't. So really what that does is it puts people like us and listeners of this podcast into this bucket of people that we're the misfits, we're the crazy ones, we're the rebels, we're those troublemakers that are going out and building stuff that are not playing by the rules. We're not doing things by the book. And I think that that's why the Startups for the Rest of Us really resonates so well with a lot of people in the audience, because they can affiliate themselves with that. They're like, I'm not following the script that the Silicon Valley people are putting out there, and I'm still being successful at it.
Yeah, and I also think there's a turn of phrase, like "for the rest of us," obviously existed in the English language, which is why it kind of came to your mind. And it means for those of us who are not privileged or who are not going after what kind of the crowd is doing and what everybody's talking about. And now there are a bunch of podcasts with similar names, which shows you that concept is like, it resonates with people. So there's Money for the Rest of Us, Minimalism for the Rest of Us, Theology for the Rest of Us, Quitting for the Rest of Us, Music Appreciation for the Rest of Us, Success for the Rest of Us, on and on and on. And I think, to be honest, we may have gotten a little lucky with it. I remember when you presented...
Oh, we totally got lucky.
We didn't actually know what we were doing. And I remember you presenting it and being like, I have this domain name. And I was like, oh, that's a great idea. You know, this totally fits what we're doing. And it's just one of those times when it fits. I think to address Ovi's broader question is, he says, you know, how do you pick your niche and even your name so you're sure you don't outgrow it yourself? Now, the niche you pick, you can always outgrow. You can always go from one vertical to a neighboring vertical. So you can go from, you know, freelance designers to freelance developers. That is not that hard, I'll say. Or going from a single vertical to going horizontal. We've seen people do it. BidSketch went from proposal software for designers to, you know, a more generalized proposal software for agencies. There's a number of examples of land and expand, right? Of coming in and serving a single market and then going out. So the niche part is not the hard part. It really is the name. You know, if Ruben had named BidSketch, you know, Design Sketch or Design Proposals or something like that, you limit yourself. And so you have to strike this balance between having a name that's too tight and having one that is so broad that it has no meaning to people, and you're then inventing your own term and having to educate on that. With that said, if you look at a lot of the names of big startups, they really aren't specific at all. And they did that by design. So Amazon.com. Bezos is a very smart guy. And I have a sinking feeling that he named it Amazon for a reason. And he knew that he wasn't just going to do books forever. He didn't name it Book Website or Cheap Books or, you know, any of those other things. He named it Amazon because he knew he was probably going to sell some DVDs and some furniture one day. Maybe he didn't know about Amazon EC2, but EC2 fits under that umbrella as well. And it's a completely different thing. Look at Uber. What does Uber mean? Like super. Is that right? In German?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, it's like above or beyond or super. It fits a lot of stuff. I think the founders of Uber probably knew that they weren't just going to be a taxi service, although early on they were called Uber Taxi, and they removed the taxi because they were being regulated as a taxi, and so they changed the name, and now they could do self-driving cars. They can do food delivery, right? There's Uber Eats. You just add the little thing to the end of it. So a lot of startups, when they actually name their startup, they are using these, it's either dictionary words or even now just not, you know, nonsense words that have a nice ring to it, and there's a reason for that, is that they don't want to get pigeonholed. So if you're naming a company, you may want to lean towards that. And again, that Tropical MBA episode that I mentioned, 401, I think it was, she talks all about this stuff. And she has an ebook actually that is phenomenal. If you want to actually hear more about naming companies, I highly recommend it. And if you are talking about naming a podcast or, you know, a blog, or you really probably can't use a nonsense name, I would have some serious brainstorms, and then I would try to strike that balance between being so wide and so narrow.
Of course, there's a danger here. There's actually a couple of dangers. One is, if you're so broad, then you have to spend a lot of time and effort educating people about what the name is. And then I think the other major danger is that you spend so much time figuring out a name that you don't actually do anything. So yeah, those are kind of other, I'll say, gotchas to kind of be aware of. Something else that comes to mind is that you can always run into a time down the road where you suddenly decide that you don't like the name, and it doesn't matter that it's doing well or the customers are resonating with it. You may just decide one day that you don't like the name, and there's almost nothing you can do about it. One that comes to mind is Fogbugs from Fog Creek Software. Last I knew, that they did not like the name, and they felt like, hey, if we could change the name to something that made more sense, we would. But at this point, it's too late. Like, everybody, there's tons of people using it. They've got thousands of customers. They're just not going to change it at this point because it doesn't make business sense. Even though they don't personally like the name anymore, it doesn't matter. The reality is that, like, the product is still making money, and it's making really good money. So they're just going to stick with it. And you may be stuck with a name you don't like, but if it's working, then does it really make that much of a difference? And the answer is probably not.
You know, Ramit Sethi with IWillTeachYouToBeRich.com regrets the name. He says it's too long. He says it sounds like, you know, he's whatever, a pyramid scheme or whatever, and he wishes it was less grandiose. I've heard Tim Ferriss talk about how 4-Hour Work Week was really a kind of a curse, a blessing and a curse, right? It sold a lot of books, but now he has this reputation and he wished he didn't. So there are interesting connotations to it. And then we can look at Tropical MBA that used to be Lifestyle Business Podcast, and they've, again, changed once already, and they're talking about changing their name again. So it's not impossible to change, especially it's harder to change a product or a company name. It can be easier to change, like, let's say, a podcast where you still have the same subscriber base and RSS feed, and you're not going to lose people. You need to rebuild the brand over time, but it's totally doable. That was a good question. Thanks for sending it in. And our last question for today is from Eric. Thanks for sending this in, Eric. It's about small business banking. He says, what options would you recommend for small business banking? I'm looking around for a local bank like Wells Fargo, Bank of America, et cetera, to start with a basic checking account. Would love to hear your thoughts. I don't think of those as local banks. I guess they have local branches, but those are like large national banks. What are your thoughts, Mike, besides the sentence that small business banking sucks? Is that what you're going to lead with?
I was, but national banks suck too. So
yeah.
Pretty much all of banking sucks.
It does. You have a ton of experience with it. What, I mean, do you have any, you know, key takeaways of like advice, or is it really just like go with where your personal stuff is? It's just so it's easy to transfer money between the two.
That's probably the best advice in most cases. Most of the business offerings are going to be pretty similar from one provider to the next. It really matters more along the lines of like what services you really need from the bank. So do you actually need to write checks? Do you need to visit a branch? There's a lot of things that you can do completely online. So obviously, like if you open up an account at most places, because, and this kind of applies specifically in the United States, which I believe he's writing to us from, you're going to have to fill out a lot of paperwork that essentially validates who you are because of all the security laws and SEC things that kind of came along after 9/11. What you'll need to do, though, is you'll need to provide proof of who you are before they'll let you open a bank account. You can do that online for certain types of banks. So Silicon Valley Bank, for example, is one where you can do that completely online. Their back-end interface kind of sucks. It's not the greatest in the world, but they have two branches. One of them is on the West Coast, one's on the East Coast, and that's it. Like if you, they'll give you a debit card, you can use it at most places. And that's really most of what you need. I mean, as long as you have online banking and you can take a picture of a check and just deposit it, it probably doesn't matter. Any bank in the world, you can just order checks from a random checking service where they just print out your checks and send them to you. They're all basically the same thing. So it's, it really comes down to like, what are you paying for in fees? And those types of things across the broad spectrum of your business probably don't matter much because you're going to be spending less than $25 or $50 a month on your banking needs, especially if you get over, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 in your banking account. And at that point, it doesn't cost you anything because they comp it and they say, well, you're a valued customer. You've got a minimum amount of money in our account, so we're not going to charge you for having this account. And at that point, what difference does it make which bank you have? And I would say that it absolutely does not. It's just which national bank do you hate the least?
Yep. I think those are good thoughts. If I were to do it all over again, I would probably do this mostly the same way I've done it, which is our personal banking is at a particular national bank. And so I've, you know, started up a couple business accounts at that same bank. And there's Bank of America and there's US Bank and there's Wells Fargo. And any of these are going to be so similar. Unless I was extremely, extremely cash strapped, that's what I would do. And you can get a business checking account at any of those banks for 10 or 15 bucks a month if you're not doing anything that fancy. And often it comes with a savings account for free attached to it. That's probably what I do. It's like keep it simple, because for 10, 15, 20 bucks a month, don't spend so much time doing stuff. The one mistake I've made in this banking stuff, or I probably made more, but the one that really comes to mind is I was being super cheap one time trying to set up this account and I didn't want to pay anything for it. And I set it up with a purely online bank, you know, of the internet or something like that. And it was just a fiasco. It took forever to get stuff through. Once I had the account, it was fine. But as you said, with Silicon Valley Bank, the interface for the one I was using was just god awful. It was very limited. So yes, I saved myself $12 a month and I regretted it every time I had to do anything with that bank. I wished I had just paid, you know, even if it was 20 bucks a month to anybody, to where I could either go to a branch or call, and it just all fit my other workflow. So I would encourage encourage you to not, you know, not try to save a few bucks. Now, maybe there's a local credit union or, you know, I'm not saying don't use a local bank because that could be great too, right? If you can go in and get personalized service, local bank, local credit union, no issues with that. But I think trying not to be, I haven't found a really clever, I always try to get the clever solution. I'm going to hack this and do a really good job. And it, thus far, it's backfired on me with banking. One thing that we will link to in the show notes is a NerdWallet article. And this is finding a free business checking account by state because they're regulated by state. You could look at this for your state and kind of look through it and see if these places look legit that are in your state. There's only a handful per state that are listed here, but it's kind of like, I don't think there's any silver bullet here.
A lot of banks will give you a business account for free for 12 months just for signing up with them. And then after that, they'll charge you $10, $15, $25 a month if you don't have that minimum balance. That's something else to keep in mind if you want to be able to save some money in the short term until your business kind of gets up and running and you're able to get some cash saved away in there. Well, I think that about wraps us up for today. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt for Route Up Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsforrestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.